Afternoon, everybody. Well, we have a nice little sitter this afternoon, quite an interesting event. This is the Magandhya Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's Sutta number 75. The setting for this sutta is that it's about a wanderer named Magandhya, and the commentary says that this wanderer had a bit of a grudge against the Buddha because the Buddha had converted one of his relatives to the teaching of the Buddha, and that he didn't like that. That had upset him previously. And as if you tried to actually picture the scene here in ancient India, this wanderer he probably would have been dressed in a very simple way, probably very similar to the ascetics of that time. Imagine him probably wearing just a very simple sort of loincloth, very probably dark, swarthy colouring, with probably his hair probably would have been done up on the top, maybe like one of these top knots. Probably would have had quite a wiry beard, and so you can imagine the sort of image that he would have been, and so then the sutta starts. Well, another thing I'd like to mention here for actually getting into the sutta is that this sutta, like a number of other suttas, is heavy on what we call the sensuality, the senses in the world, the whole sort of the realm of the senses, and the Buddha here is illustrating in very sort of heavy tones, if you like, problems that arise from sensuality. Now, the thing is, Buddhism tends to get a bad name because people think it's pessimistic. People think that you can't enjoy yourself, and it's all sort of very mean and ascetic, and so it's not much fun being a Buddhist. but if you pay attention to the sutta, what you'll see is that that's not what the Buddha is saying. The Buddha is saying that one who is addicted to the senses, like it comes clear that Magandhya here, he is what they call a sensualist. That was the path that he followed. That's what he considered that life was about, living experience to the full, all the whole range of the senses that could be experienced, living that to the full. That was his whole view, and that's what life was all about. That was his purpose. That was his whole way to liberation, he believed, was through these senses. And so the Buddha is illustrating here that in fact, not only is that not the way, but in fact, that in itself is the cause of the whole problem. And it's not as if that the Buddha is saying there's anything wrong with the senses particularly. The Buddha is saying that if you're going to indulge in something fully, then there are other things, there are other paths, other ways which are more profitable and far more enjoyable, that you can get a lot more out of living and the practice than just exploring the sensations of the senses. So the Buddha isn't being a pessimist. He's saying that There is enjoyment and happiness to be got, but it's superior. It's a superior happiness than that which can be found by fully exploring and indulging in the senses. Okay. So the Buddha, the sutta starts. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country at a town of the Kurus named Kamasadamma. On a spread of grass in the fire chamber of a Brahmin belonging to the Bharavaja clan. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went into Kamasadamma for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kamasadamma and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to a certain grove for the day's abiding. Having entered the grove, he sat down at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. Then the wanderer Magandhya, while walking and wandering for exercise, went to the fire chamber of the Brahmin belonging to the Bharavaja clan. There he saw the spread of grass prepared and asked the Brahmin, "For whom has this spread of grass been prepared in Master Bharavaja's fire chamber? It seems like a recluse's bed." "Master Magandhya, there is the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. That Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. This bed has been prepared for that Master Gotama. Indeed, Master Bharavaja, it is an ill sight we see when we see the bed of that destroyer of growth, Master Gotama." "Be careful what you say, Magandhya, be careful what you say. Many learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders, and learned recluses have full confidence in Master Gotama and have been disciplined by him in the noble true way, in the Dharma that is wholesome. Master Bharavaja, even if we saw that Master Gotama face to face, we would tell him to his face, 'The recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth.' Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. If Master Magandhya has no objection, may I tell this to Master Gotama? Let Master Bharavaja be at ease. Tell him just what I have said. Meanwhile, with the divine ear, which is purified and surpasses the human, the Blessed One heard this conversation between the Brahmin of the Bharavaja clan and the wanderer Magandhya. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from his meditation and went to the Brahmin's fire chamber and sat down on the spread of grass made ready. Then the Brahmin of the Bharavaja clan went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down to one side. The Blessed One asked him, "Bharavaja, did you have any conversation with the wanderer Magandhya about this spread of grass?" When this was said, the Brahmin, awestruck and with his hair standing on end, replied, "We wanted to tell Master Gotama about that very thing, but Master Gotama has anticipated us." But this discussion between the Blessed One and the Brahmin of the Bharavaja clan was left unfinished, for then the wanderer Magandhya, while walking and wandering for exercise, came to the Brahmin's fire chamber and went up to the Blessed One. He exchanged greetings with the Blessed One, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. The Blessed One said to him, "Magandhya, the eye takes delight in forms, rejoices in forms. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained, and he teaches the Dharma for its restraint. Was it with reference to this that you said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth?" "It was with a reference to this, Master Gotama, that I said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. The ear delights in sound, the nose delights in odors, the tongue delights in flavors, the body delights in tangibles, the mind delights in mind objects, takes delight in mind objects, rejoices in mind objects. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained, and he teaches the Dharma for its restraint. Was it with reference to this that you said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth?" "It was with reference to this, Master Gotama, that I said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. What do you think, Magandhya? Here someone may have formerly enjoyed himself with forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood, as they actually are, the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of forms, he might abandon craving for forms, remove fever for forms, and abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. What would you say to him, Magandhya?" "Nothing, Master Gotama." I find that an extraordinary reply. It doesn't really have anything worthwhile to say other than doesn't make any difference to him anyway. He's from his way of life, nothing. "What do you think, Magandhya? Here someone may have formerly enjoyed himself with sounds cognizable by ear, odors cognizable by nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of tangibles, that's in the case of all of these, but just ends up with the last one, last reference, the escape in the case of tangibles, he might abandon craving for tangibles, remove fever for tangibles, and abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace." So in other words here, the Buddha is saying that someone who has seen the danger in lust has managed to actually overcome these things and now lives happily a peaceful life as a result of that. What would you say to him, Magandhya?" "Nothing, Master Gotama." "Magandhya, formerly, when I lived the home life, I enjoyed myself, provided and endowed with the five cores of sensual pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, with flavours cognisable by the tongue, tangibles cognisable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likeable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. I had three palaces, one for the rainy season, one for the winter season, and one for the summer. I lived in the rain's palace for 4 months of the rainy season, enjoying myself with musicians who were all female, and I did not go down to the lower palace. On a later occasion, having understood, as they actually are, the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of sensual pleasures, I abandoned craving for sensual pleasures. I removed fever for sensual pleasures, and I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust, from sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with fever for sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because there is, Magandhya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses divine bliss, which I take delight. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. Suppose, Magandhya, a householder or a householder's son was rich, with great wealth and property, and being provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, he might enjoy himself with forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. Having conducted himself well in body, speech, and mind, on the dissolution of the body after death, he might reappear in a happy destination, in a heavenly world, in the retinue of the gods of the 33. So the interesting thing about this little paragraph is that this is a person who has engaged with sensual pleasures fully in the world, but he has done this in a wholesome way. He's not devoured by craving and lust. So therefore, you know, it's an example of someone who is living sensibly in the world, and he's living a decent life. So and after that, then he goes to a heavenly realm. In a heavenly world, in a retinue of the gods of the 33, and there, surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nadanda Grove, he would enjoy himself, provided and endowed with the five cords of divine sensual pleasures. Suppose he saw a householder or a householder's son enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the five cords of human sensual pleasure. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that young god, surrounded by the group of nymphs in the Nadanda Grove, enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the five cords of divine sensual pleasure, envy that householder or householder's son for the five cords of human sensual pleasure, or would he return to human sensual pleasures? No, Master Gotama. And why not? Because heavenly sensual pleasures are more excellent and sublime than human sensual pleasures. So too, Magandhya, formerly when I lived the home life, I enjoyed myself, provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, tangibles cognizable by the body, that I wished for and desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood, as they actually are, the gratification, the danger and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures. I abandoned craving for sensual pleasures. I removed fever for sensual pleasures. And I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with fever for sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because there is, Magandhya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. So the Buddha is clearly hitting Magandhya very hard here, because he knows what the Magandhya's doctrine is, if you like, that he's sacrificing all else just for completely indulging in sensual pleasures, and the Buddha is making it quite clear to him that that there really is very limited profit in this, if he's actually, if he is really concerned in leading a spiritual life and is looking for liberation, that maybe there's a liberation which is greater than that which will be found in these sensual pleasures. Suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper. I have to tell you to brace yourselves now, because the Buddha starts getting into some quite heavy similes here. It can be a little bit shocking. Suppose, Gandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. The reference here is this cauterizing the body over a burning charcoal pit was apparently lepers, what they would, one of the practices lepers would practice in those days was that when these sores would arise on the body, by using hot coals, they would put these burning hot coals onto these sores, and this would give them some relief from the irritation of these sores. But then not only that, not only could they get irritation from these sores, but sometimes they could actually get quite a sensual feeling from this, this dreadful practice. And this is what the Buddha is referring to here. These lepers could actually think they're actually getting some benefit from the pleasure of cauterizing their sores with these burning coals. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, that man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then he might see another leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that man envy that leper for his burning charcoal pit or his use of medicines? No, Master Gotama. And why is that? Because when there is sickness, medicine has to be made. And when there is no sickness, medicine does not have to be made. So too, Magandhya, formerly, when I lived the home life, this is abbreviated here, as the Buddha just repeats the statements he's made before. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. Suppose, Magandia, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicines for him, and by means of that medicine, that man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then two young men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. The illustration here is being given, if it's not immediately obvious, is so before this leper delighted in this charcoal pit, which was a very dangerous thing. It was burning hot, not a suitable thing to bring in contact with the body. But the leper didn't realize that. To him, this charcoal pit was something pleasurable when he'd go to. But now the Buddha is saying, when the man is actually healthy, even if two strong men were to grab hold of him and drag him towards that pit, he would be terrified. He wouldn't want to go there because it's not the place for a healthy person, and he would do his best to get away. What do you think, Magandia? Then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandia? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think, Magandia? Is it only now that that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching, or previously too was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gotama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching, and previously too that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. And when that man was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he mistakenly perceived it as pleasant. So too, Magandia, in the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now, at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But these beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, though sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch, they acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. Now, this might seem a bit over the top, that paragraph there. But what the Buddha is saying here is that this you could say is a whole reference to the basic condition that all beings are in and human beings are in. This is samsara itself. The Buddha here isn't saying that just sensual pleasures are damaging, scorching, burning, and suffering. Reference here is when they are, when beings are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures and lusts. That's when that is when the situation, you could say, that's basically the situation that causes beings to be attached to existence. This is giving like a very drastic simile here. But the situation is that even any sort of sensuality is a cause for any sort of clinging. I mean, we are here, beings are here in existence because of sensuality. And sooner or later, this whole condition becomes becomes unsatisfactory. And so it's sooner or later we are going to experience the dissatisfaction of just being in existence. So although this isn't immediately apparent from our everyday lives, but the fact is that that there is rebirth. You know, beings do come back to existence due to attachment to existence, which and that that attachment is due to basically sensual pleasures and the desiring for the renewal of being due to just basic desire. And so it's that business of continually coming back and not being able to get away from existence. And in that sense, it's a painful thing, because when situations do get bad, you know, when real tragedies happen in people's lives, it's then that they realize the actual problem of existing. And, you know, how do you get away from it? You know, you're just there in it. And so it's on occasions when it becomes really painful and noticeable that that this reference is about. Suppose Magandia, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Now this too is the Buddha becoming even more explicit. You can say the dilemma. This little paragraph now is the basic dilemma of, you can say, the addiction, the basic mental addiction of being, of being in this samsaric condition. Right, then it says, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. The more he scratches the scabs and cauterizes his body, the fouler, the more evil smelling, the more infected the openings of his wounds would become. Yet he would find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in scratching the opening of his wounds. So too, Magandhir, beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, still indulge in sensual pleasures. The more such beings indulge in sensual pleasures, the more their craving for sensual pleasures increases, and the more they are burned by their fever for sensual pleasures. Yet they find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in dependence on the five causes of sensual pleasure. So there it is laid out in a very explicit way. What do you think, Magandia? Have you ever seen or heard of a king or king's minister enjoying himself, provided and endowed the five causes of sense pleasures, who, without abandoning craving for sensual pleasures, without removing fever for sensual pleasures, was able to abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace, or who is able, or who will be able to so abide? No, Master Gotama. Good Magandia, I too have never seen or heard of a king or a king's minister enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the five causes of sensual pleasure, who, without abandoning craving for sensual pleasures, without removing fever for sensual pleasures, was able to abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace? Or who is able or who will be able to so abide? On the contrary, Magandhya, those recluses or Brahmins who abide or will abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace, all do so after having understood, as they actually are, the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures. And it is after abandoning craving for sensual pleasures and removing fever for sensual pleasures that they abide or will abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. Then at that point, the Blessed One uttered this exclamation: the greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. The eightfold path is the best of paths, for it leads safely to the deathless. When this was said, the wanderer Magandhya said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Master Gotama, it is marvellous how well that has been expressed by Master Gotama. The greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. We too have heard this said by earlier wanderers in the tradition of the teachers, and it agrees, Master Gotama. But Magandhya, when you heard that said by earlier wanderers in the tradition of the teachers, what is that health? What is that Nibbana?" When this was said, the wanderer Magandhya rubbed his limbs with his hands and said, "This is that health, Master Gotama. This is that Nibbana. For I am now healthy and happy, and nothing afflicts me." Magandhya, suppose there was a man born blind, who could not see dark and light forms, who could not see blue, yellow, red, or pink forms, who could not see what was even and uneven, who could not see the stars or the sun and moon. He might hear a man with good eyesight saying, "Good indeed, sirs, is a white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean." And he would go in search of a white cloth. Then a man would cheat him with a dirty, soiled garment, thus, "Good man, this is a white cloth for you, beautiful, spotless, and clean." And he would accept it and put it on, and being satisfied with it, he would utter words of satisfaction, thus, "Good indeed, sirs, is a white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean." What do you think, Magandhya? When that man, born blind, accepted that dirty soiled garment, put it on, and being satisfied with it, uttered words of satisfaction thus, "Good indeed, sirs, is a white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean," did he do so knowing and seeing, or out of faith in the man with good eyesight? Venerable sir, he would have done so unknowing, unseeing, out of faith in the man with good eyesight. So too, Magandhya, the wanderers of other sects are blind and visionless. They do not know health. They do not see Nibbana. Yet they utter this stanza thus: the greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. This stanza was uttered by the earlier accomplished ones, fully enlightened ones, thus: the greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. The eightfold path is the best of paths, for it leads safely to the deathless. Now it has gradually become current among ordinary people. And although this body, Magandhya, is a disease, a tumour, a dart, a calamity, and an affliction, referring to this body, you say, "This is that health. This is that health, Master Gotama. This is that Nibbana." You do not have the noble vision, Magandhya, by means of which you might know health and see Nibbana. So what the Buddha is saying here is, he's not saying that a healthy body is an affliction, or a dart, or any great problem. What he's saying is that people who become obsessed with the body are missing the fact that the liability of the body, because sooner or later this body does break up and it causes all sorts of problems. So if it's the body that you take refuge in, sooner or later you're going to see that this body is in fact an affliction. So then, at this point, Magandia starts wavering in his beliefs, and he starts thinking, well, maybe this Master Gotama knows what he's talking about. So then he says, I have confidence in Master Gotama thus. Master Gotama is capable of teaching me the Dharma in such a way that I can come to know health and see Nibbana. Magandhya, suppose there was a man born blind who did not see dark and light forms or the sun and the moon. When his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him, the physician would make a medicine for him, yet by means of that medicine the man's vision would not arise or be purified. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that doctor reap weariness and disappointment? Yes, Master Gotama. So too, Magandhya, if I were to teach you the Dharma thus, this is that health, this is that Nibbana, you might not know health or see Nibbana, and that would be wearisome and troublesome for me. I have confidence in Master Gotama thus. Master Gotama is capable of teaching me the Dharma in such a way that I can come to know health and see this Nibbana. Magandhya, suppose there was a man born blind who could not see dark and light forms or sun or moon. He might hear a man with good eyesight saying, good indeed, sirs, is this white cloth beautiful, spotless and clean? And he would go in search of a white cloth. Then a man would cheat him with a dirty, soiled garment. Good man, here is a white cloth for you, beautiful, spotless and clean. And he would accept it and put it on. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicines, emetics, purgatives, ointments, counter ointments, navel ointments and treatments. And by means of that medicine, that man's vision would arise and be purified. Together with the arising of his vision, his desire and liking for that dirty soiled garment would be abandoned. Then he might burn with indignation and enmity towards that man, and might think that he ought to be killed thus. Indeed, I have long been tricked, cheated and defrauded by this man with this dirty soiled garment. When he told me, good man, here is a white cloth for you, beautiful and spotless and clean. So too, Magandhya, if I were to teach you the Dharma thus, this is that health, this is that Nibbana, you might know health and see Nibbana. Together with the arising of your vision, your desire for lust for the five aggregates affected by clinging might be abandoned. So here suddenly the Buddha stopped using the illustrations and similes, and he's gone right to the point of what the problem is. He's saying that it's these five aggregates of clinging, which are basically the problem, which is deluding Magandhya. Now that is, the five aggregates are basically, they are the form, basically the physical body, feelings, the perceptions, thought formations, and consciousness. And these are things that we just automatically cling to and think are the reality. We think that they are a self. And this is what's been happening with, in the case of Magandia, like everybody else. He's been thinking that he is actually existing as a being, but what's been happening is he's just been clinging to all these aggregates of existence that have been arising, and he's been mistaking these for a self, just as same as if he'd been tricked by someone with good, just as a blind person being tricked with someone, just as a blind person being tricked by someone with good eyes into believing that a dirty cloth is a nice white cloth. Together with the arising of your vision, your desire and lust for the five aggregates afflicted by clinging might be abandoned. Then, perhaps, you might think, indeed, I have long been tricked, cheated, and defrauded by this mind. For when clinging, I have been clinging just to material form. I have been clinging just to feeling. I have been clinging just to perception. I have been clinging just to formations. I have been clinging just to consciousness. With my clinging as condition, being comes to be. With being as condition, birth comes to be. With birth as condition, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So, that basically is the condition of existence which we're caught up in. You could say this is like the dependent origination. That it's just by clinging to these aggregates, thinking them to be a self, that we stay in existence. That's all that stays in existence, is just basically those aggregates. I have confidence in Master Gotama thus. Master Gotama is capable of teaching me the Dharma in such a way that I might rise up from this seat cured of my blindness. Then, Magandia, associate with true men. When you associate with true men, you will hear the true Dharma. When you hear the true Dharma, you will practice in accordance with the true Dharma. When you practice in accordance with the true Dharma, you will know and see for yourself thus. These are diseases, tumours and darts. But here these diseases, tumours and darts cease without remainder. So basically the Buddha is saying here they cease without remainder. So from the point of view where the Buddha is, from the Buddha's perspective, following the way, the teaching of the Buddha, then right here, these aggregates cease without remainder. With the cessation of my clinging comes cessation of being. With the cessation of being, the cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. When this was said, the wanderer Magandia said, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what has been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, to the Dharma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission." Magandia, one who formerly belonged to another sect and desires to go forth and the full admission in this Dharma and discipline, lives on probation for 4 months. At the end of 4 months, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with him, they give him the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhu state. But I recognize individual differences in this matter. Venerable sir, if those who formerly belonged to another sect and desired the going forth and full admission in this Dharma and discipline, live on probation for 4 months, and if at the end of 4 months the bhikkhu is being satisfied with them, give them the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhu state, then I will live on probation for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with me, let them give me the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhu state. Then the wanderer Magandhi, receiving the going forth under the Blessed One, received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Magandhya, by realizing for himself, with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from their home into homelessness, he directly knew birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Magandhya became one of the Arahants. And that is the sutta. So, are there any questions regarding that? Yes, yes. In this case, like the previous Buddhas, in this actual aeon, there's been quite a number of Buddhas, apparently, which is quite rare. But the last Buddha, Kassapa, in terms of when Buddhas, the cycle of time that Buddhas do arrive, come and go, he wasn't so long ago. And this is implied here that although it was a very long time ago, because of the teaching, which was an enlightened teaching, still shreds of it, you know, that the wisdom of the elders is still sort of there, peppered about in existence, still remains, and there are shreds of this everywhere. There are lots of wise sayings and things. And people, you know, pick these up and keep them, put them, incorporate them into their own systems. But you wouldn't, you know, a person wouldn't know where they originated from. But it's only when another Buddha comes into the world that he can identify which are these enlightened statements. He would be able to see that particular verse corresponds exactly to his own teaching, and it would be apparent to him that this came from an enlightened being, and because being a Buddha, he would be able to see back exactly to the point where this arose in the world, this saying, and he would see that it would have gone right back to the previous Buddha. But of course, only the Buddha would be able to see that. Devas. Yeah, well, you know, there is a school of belief that believes that people, devas do interact with people on the world, in the world, and attain practitioners are able to actually visit these deva realms. So it's not impossible that information from the deva realms could be given to people and then become current in the world, sayings. Magandhya. Well, this expression in our scriptures that that's an expression that Bhikkhu Bodhi has used just to give a reference to the lineage, the teaching of that particular sect. We don't know what it is, but when we, in terms of, it wouldn't actually be scriptures in the sense that there's any sort of text, because they, you know, nothing was written down in those days. It was all, the teaching was passed on orally. So basically this expression, it's in our scriptures, is simply a reference to this was beliefs that the sect of Magandhya held. Not particularly. Well, this is more like sort of modern day psychological sort of analytical ways of seeing the situation. Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's, problems people have today are the same problems people had then. It's the same mind, same psyche. Yeah, that's a good point that you're making. It's the way you do this. What the Buddha is saying here, like what you're saying, is that a person that gets addicted to something, or tends to feel they're addicted to something, then wants to shy away from that, tries to, and that they might sort of repress that in some way, and that in itself would then cause another problem. This is why the teaching of the Eightfold Path is the important thing here, because the Buddha makes this statement and he says the way out of this is the Eightfold Path, and therefore. In the Eightfold Path, you get Samma Sati, right mindfulness, Samma Samadhi, right contemplation, and this is where you actually need to get into meditation, so that you can actually experience the mind in a way where you can actually watch the mind. So you can actually see, the nature of the mind by actually contemplating it in a very precise way. You know, you can see what comes up. You spend a lot of time and patience just being with this mind. And so when an addiction arises, or a lust for some sensuality, you can see that very clearly. And if you know you have an addiction, if you have an addiction and then you know it, then you can see it, and then just that seeing of it, you know, it makes it more clear. And then if you then try to deny that in some way, equally the fact that you're doing the practice of meditation, you know, sammasati, you're looking very clearly at the situation, then the fact that you're denying something becomes apparent to the wisdom in the mind, and the consciousness can see. Because what you're saying here is very relevant. How do we deal with these very, very complicated processes of the mind? You know, this whole delusory psychological condition, which everybody's in, basically. You're saying it. To an extent that everybody is suffering from addictions of some sort or another, is suffering from aversions, is running away from something, running after something. And you can never really know, you know, because it's so subjective. It's a very difficult thing to know. That's why it's other people that tend to point out your faults, you know, because they're not faults of you. It's your way of life, you know. Your habits are naturalness, you know, but it tends to be other people that point them out, you know. Then, you know, you suddenly get taken back, you know. You reverse to someone else pointing out something to you, which is maybe very personal, and what you might feel is very natural, and they might actually see what you think is your nature as just a bad habit. You know? So, this great psychological complication that we are always in, I mean, the Buddha makes no doubt about it, there is no other way out of this except to be introspective and self-analytical, you know, turn inwards and just give yourself a chance to look at that process, you know, just to look at it, not saying you go in there and mix it and sort of try and rearrange it. You just actually allow yourself a space so you can actually look at it and get a chance to see it. Because it's all there. It's all quite comprehensible. If you get a chance to look at it from the right perspective, and if you're truthful, then you can see addictions. You can then see your reaction to addictions. You can then see if you're getting into denial in addiction. You can then see if you're suffering an adverse effect because you are refusing to face an addiction, or you're trying to turn away from it in such a way that you're causing some sort of abrasion in another direction. You can see these things by sama samadhi, basically, by right contemplation. In other words, the Buddha, after having made all these statements, then will always say, you know, it's the Four Noble Truths, it's the Eightfold Path, which is the way out of this condition. But it is, as you point out, it is quite a complex issue that is being dealt with here. Sorry, say that again? Well, clear comprehension, that's it, basically. It's only through clear comprehension that you can actually get a perspective on really what's happening with you. Well, yeah, you mentioned the Satipatthana Sutta, but that's also mindfulness of the body. You know, there is a whole meditation technique, a whole range of meditation techniques, simply using the body as the meditation object. You know, the Buddha said that he who neglects contemplation of the body neglects the deathless. In other words, it's vital. It's very important if you really want to engage with this this whole practice of release. It is this body. In fact, there's one place that the Buddha said, the whole universe, it can all be summed up. You don't need to go to the other end of the universe to know what it consists of. You can find out everything in this fathom-length body, in this mind, in this body. You just contemplate this fully, then that is the way through. The answers to release are right here. They're right here, you know, with you, inside you. You don't need to go further than this fathom-length body. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that's the. That's a point I was trying to make at the beginning. Perhaps I didn't give you enough explanation, and that is that this process it is a very long process, and from. On a day-to-day level, it's very hard for us to identify the fact that it is this sensuality which is the problem, because we identify all our well-being. Generally speaking, people identify their well-being in terms of some sort of sensuality, some sort of satisfaction within the sensual realm, you know, and they think this is what life's all about. You know, you here getting satisfaction from what you can get out of that world that makes this world what makes you feel good. You know, that's, you know, like we eat, you know, we eat and we drink and we breathe, and this is what keeps this body going. It's living on or devouring the world. And so, that's what I was saying, when the Buddha was giving these very explicit statements to Magandhya, you know, but he was talking in terms of this lust and craving for sensuality, you know, which is the suffering and the problem. He was giving a very strong black and white illustration of the whole thing. You know, if you saw the whole thing in very black and white terms, that's what it is. But when you see it thinned out and watered out in the terms of everyday lives of people, that comparison, that contrast isn't there. You know, we just think we're existing in the world because we have to feed. You know, this body is a sensual body. This is a very sensual organism. You know, it's just one. We're just one mass of senses, isn't it? The whole body is just one very sensitive organ. And so it's necessary to see that going from various stages, a person that's like I mentioned, the man in the sutta that lived his life enjoying the normal sensual pleasures which people enjoy, but in a wholesome way, you know, that's perfectly okay. And then he goes to heaven, you know, but the other extreme is the person that becomes. It's the addictive, you know, the person that becomes addictive to sensual pleasures. They are the persons at most at risk. But everybody has this potential. You know, if you've got this body, you don't, you know, it can happen to you. You've got this mind and body. You're within that system where you can actually get caught in that. So the Buddha said, as long as you're in this condition system. You need to be conscious and aware of the danger. It's much better to be out of it. But it's very difficult for the average person who just starts, a beginner, to appreciate that. So the Buddha didn't hit them so heavy. You know? The Buddha tells Magandhya, he gives it to him straight, because he can see Magandhya is a very highly attained being. You know, He's a wanderer, he's practiced spirituality for a long time, and he's close to enlightenment. But he still has wrong, pernicious views that will send him completely off track. He can miss the point, and he can go down. He can lose what gains he's made. So the Buddha at that point hits him very hard and tells him very explicitly. The Buddha would not say that to the average ordinary householder. Now, he would give him information about being generous. You know, practice generosity, practice morality. And then, you know, if you live a good, wholesome, decent life, then there's a good chance that you'll go to heaven. You know, like ordinary sort of basic religions. You know, the ordinary basic religion doesn't have the sort of full understanding of a Buddha. That's the level they go. That's the only level they can really relate on. Be a good person, be a moral person, and you'll go to heaven, and you'll reap the benefits of heavenly existence. And that's the teaching that the Buddha gave to the average person. But when they got an insight into the teaching, into samsara, the conditioned nature of samsara, and the fact that there is no real satisfaction that can be found in this system. Now, in the world, the whole thing is conditioned. Because it's conditioned, you can adjust the conditions best you can, and you can make a good situation. Now, you can get a lot of happiness by adjusting the conditions in such a way that you're living happily and comfortably, pleasurably. But the fact that it's always conditioned, you can't go beyond the conditioning. You've continually got to adjust and maintain those conditions so that you keep that happiness and pleasure. But because it's always conditioned and you don't go beyond it, there is always this threat that the condition is going to reverse. The condition is going to collapse. It's going to become out of condition, and then you're really going to suffer. You know, then you're really going to find the other extent of this sensual body, this sensual system. You know, on one hand, it experiences a great deal of pleasure, you know, ecstatic pleasure. You know, but of course, the other end, the polar opposite to that, it also registers discomfort and agony. You know, so that's the system you're in. You know, you're suspended between agony and ecstasy. You know, and you've always got to maintain, keep adjusting the conditions to keep your happiness and welfare. And the Buddha's saying, when someone sees that, you know, when someone actually sees that condition, then they want to get off that. You know, whatever the benefits you can get off from this system, no matter how highly pleasurable they are, when you know how that it's a continual liability that you can never win because there isn't any lasting satisfaction in a conditioned system, then when people see that, then the Buddha shows them the way out of existence to get off the wheel. Yeah? Yeah, well, that situation is occurring, you know, all the way through. You never get away from that until you're enlightened. You know, that continual need to continue adjusting, like the Buddha says that there's the four right efforts. The four right efforts are, you know, you get rid of any evil or unwholesomeness that you're involved with, and then you prevent more unwholesomeness arising. You then get wholesome qualities, that you haven't already got, and then you maintain wholesome qualities that you have got. And this four right efforts goes all the way through. Even however high a practitioner is, he's got to continually maintain his right view. You know, the first of the Eightfold Path, keeping the right view, because anybody can go off at any point, even very highly attained practitioners. Like in the teaching of Devadatta, suddenly the whole thing went sour. He got caught up with the power, the power of his practice overtook him, and he got this craving for power and honour and fame, and that just blew his whole practice. So not until you're enlightened. Are you absolutely, totally enlightened? Is there any safety in this system? Well, there's the Eightfold Path. As a lay person, you've got the basic, your precepts, right? Either the five precepts or the eight precepts. You've got consciousness of the straight and narrow. And no matter how often you go off the path, that reference, the precepts and the Eightfold Path, is always there for you. Depends on how diligent you are to see that. Is that the answer to your question? But I mean, that's in you. I mean, that's the consciousness in you that realizes. But I mean, it's inside you. It's the practice that you've done that is instilled in you that there is the right and there is the wrong. Now, if it's instinctual in you, the right way and the wrong way, then the cultivation of the right way inside you will always pull you back again. It might be sort of unconscious, but it's due to having practiced right way. That thing that will pull you, we call it normally conscious, conscience. But it's there in everybody. Okay, so I think that's good enough for one session.